By the end of the first act, the stage is trashed. It is a complete mess. And the interval is basically someone just sweeping up the stage and cleaning it.
Rusty Quill presents Enthusiasm. Hello, friends and fans, and welcome to Enthusiasm, the show where we talk about a few of our favourite things. I'm your host, Helen Gould, one of the best Rusty Quillers, and today we're talking about opera. And I am delighted to be joined by Anil, Katie, and Lowry. Anil, can you give us your pronouns and tell us what you do?
Hi, I'm Anil Gunagamur, he, him, and I am Rusty Quill's Chief Compliance Officer.
Katie, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hi, I'm she, her, and I was the producer of this podcast that was called Stella Firma. Recently started a new role making content for all our lovely Patreons, which I'm very excited about.
Aw, you're very good at it. I'm enjoying all the stuff you're putting out. Lowry, my darling. Please introduce yourself, give us your pronouns, and tell us what you do.
Hello, Lowry, she, her, and I produce Enthusiasm.
Yay!
I also edit for Rusty Quill Gaming, and I said that with a question at the end because I was like, is it still going on when this comes out? I think it probably is.
It will be, yeah.
And I'm actually getting very emotional as we get closer to the end.
Oh, yes, of course.
I'm editing episode 216 right now, just for context, and it's a lot.
Oh.
It's a lot.
Well,
anyway.
F for you, Lowry. All right, so we're going to start with what is becoming quite a typical question, which is, how did each of you get into opera? Because it is kind of famously a reasonably exclusive interest. So what happened? Someone tell me your journey.
I was into opera from a very young age because several of my family are opera singers.
What?
And I mean, amateur opera singers, but like singing is, the stereotype of the Welsh singer is there for a reason.
Yeah, I can totally verify. My husband is from Wales. It is true.
We love to sing.
Any excuse to burst into song.
Yes, you're not wrong. I expect I will be singing on this episode, and I am not the opera singer amongst the four of us. So sorry, everyone. Yeah, and my gran was an opera singer. Lots of my uncles and aunts are opera singers. You know, always in choirs. My mum sings. So there were loads of opera records and videos around the house that I grew up in, and I just used to listen to them like and sing along and dance to them in the middle room when I was little and go to rehearsals and things like that.
That's Aww. Super cool.
So yeah,
so did you get drawn into any of these rehearsals?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, excellent.
I did years and years of amateur operatics with my mother.
Oh.
And it wasn't full opera. We did a lot of operettas and musicals.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've never gone into opera singer. I would be more of a musical kind of singer. But yeah, I love it.
Aw. Anil, how about you?
So I suspect I'm coming at this from like completely different from Lowry and Katie, because I don't come from a musical family. Like, music is not a big thing for my immediate family. Like, my grandmother apparently was a piano teacher and taught piano and singing. But because she lived in Sri Lanka, none of that really came around for me and my sister. My sister played the flute a bit. But bit of a digression. How I got into it was, my mother is a nurse. And for a long while, and I don't know if this scheme is still running, a lot of the London theatre houses and opera halls, if they had spare tickets for shows, they would put an allocation of these tickets into a pool, which London's first responders and care professionals could access.
Oh,
that's cool.
So if you were available on short notice, you might be able to pick up like stalls or circle seats at a vastly reduced rate, because just so that they would have people filling the seats. my mum was a nurse. She got access to this pool, and I was the only one in the family who had any interest in going to see theatrical performances and things like that. And then one day she said, oh, I have tickets for an opera, or I can get access to an opera at the English National Opera at the Coliseum. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll go along. Because primarily up to that point, it had been like RSC Productions, the National and so forth.
RSC is Royal Shakespeare Company, right?
Royal Shakespeare Company. Yeah, I got to see a lot of Shakespeare that way.
Cool.
Amazing.
And so, yeah, I went along to the English National Opera. I can't exactly remember which show it was, but it was definitely, I enjoyed this enough that if you get more opera tickets, I will quite happily go along.
Wow. So was that like a little tradition that you had?
Yeah. So whenever my mum could go along with me, or sometimes it was just I would go on my own. And it's really weird because while I have issues like going to the cinema or something on my own, I am very happy to go to the theatre on my own and go and see a musical production or a musical, partly because I know that I have very few close friends as well who would be available on short notice to go and see it. Often it's like if I wanted to, it would have to be on my own. But I really enjoy like sitting there in the vast hall, enjoying this music that's reverberating around you that is just so grand.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I go to the cinema often on my own and also to the theatre when there's something I want to see very much. So yeah. I remember seeing Hamilton and I was just in bits, like for the entire last 15 minutes. Because the fact that it's live, and of course you get this with films as well, but like with theatre particularly, you can't pause it and there's like an immediacy to it that you don't get with movies, especially when people are singing.
Yeah.
And I'm also so invested because I'm like, oh, that's so difficult to sing. I really hope that you can keep that up. And they always do. They always do.
I think there's a physicality about when you're in the same room as the people, because it's actually, people have to use their whole body to make these sounds.
Yes.
And somehow when you're in the room, you can tell. And that's part of the thrill of it.
Yes.
You know, obviously the wonderful systems they have for the sound in the cinemas are incredible in a different way, so you get the huge impact, but it's not got that sort of human effort behind it that you can actually feel.
Yeah. Well, since you're having a chat, can you tell us how you got into opera then, Katie?
All right. it was quite the journey.
Oh, good.
So as a kid when I was growing up, my parents were not into that sort of thing at all. Like you said, the perception of it being a bit elite really put them off. And they would say so quite openly to me and everything. But I would have been about 9 or 10. And a couple of things happened. First of all, I had a friend at school. Her parents were separated and her dad was a merchant banker. And so he was really well off. And he used to take her for weekends in London where he lived. They used to get complimentary tickets to Covent Garden.
Wow.
And she invited me along one day for the weekend with her dad to go and see this opera. And I remember really clearly it was Hansel and Gretel.
Oh.
And I remember everything about it. Like the production was trying to bring out, I think they thought I didn't understand because I was only 9. But it was clearly the director was trying to sort of look at domestic abuse and that sort of thing, because all the way through the rich scene, dad was just sitting there reading the paper in the corner and all of these little details just vividly remember. But the thing I remember the most about it was just the atmosphere. I mean, it was just the magic of it, you know, because these were complimentary business tickets. It was something like 5th row of the stalls in the middle. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I didn't realise at the time, but it would have cost about 200 quid for this ticket, you know, that was sitting in age 9, like clueless. But it's just everything, like from the sound of the orchestra tuning up and how it sounds in that big room and just kind of the magic of the lights going off. It was just amazing. And just the whole thing of being in London and being bought dinner afterwards really late at night. One day, and I can't remember how it happened, I discovered my upper register. And I'm like, I'm quite a stocky build and I've got like a really fat head. I've got wide cheekbones. And it turns out that like this was a really strong part of my voice. And I remember that I used to like opera. So I started getting the train into London and going to E&O and watching them either by myself or with my sister. And by then my mum was starting to sort of relax on the whole thing and she was getting into it too. So I got my mum too. I started to try to sing like that myself and it felt incredible. And so I went to this masterclass thingy near where I lived and sung like completely inappropriate repertoire for someone my age. It was Pamina Zahra from the Magic Flute. But the guy who was running the masterclass was a chorus member in English National Opera.
Mm. Oh, that's the ENO.
ENO, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he said, you've got loads of potential. Would you like to start coming down with me and just sort of observing rehearsals and meeting singers and that sort of thing?
Oh my gosh, amazing.
I never knew that. That's so cool.
Yeah. So I did that like for a few years. He was fantastic. I got to go to dress rehearsals, which was really good because obviously it was free performance, but also wow. I got to go to pre-dress rehearsals, which was even better because you could see them getting the direction and talking about it and all that sort of thing. And it was just incredible. Mm. You'd go backstage and you'd go into the canteen with the stuff, and you'd walk in, there'd be this kind of wall of, you know, because everyone was talking like an opera singer. And yeah, then I went up to uni and I studied music. And I, by then, singing was my first instrument. Mm. So I was having lessons. And my plan by then, I met a bunch of people who were also into opera and just that stuff in general. And my plan had been going to do postgrad in singing and actually try to get into singing myself. Mm. And I got as far as the auditions and they said, loads of potential, but you're a bit rough and ready. You know, you haven't got a good technique. You've not obviously not sort of been brought up in this. Go have some more lessons, come back next year. Mm. Having about the confidence of no confidence at all. Oh. I heard, you're rubbish, go away.
Oh, no.
And by that time, I'd been on an aeroplane and I was getting obsessed with that. So I went off and became a pilot instead.
What? Wow. What?
You're a pilot? You can fly a plane?
I didn't know that. I'm sorry. No idea, Lowry.
No, I... Wow.
Yeah, I remain into it. And I feel like after I'd had my children, I got into creative music, which is probably where I'm supposed to be. And I was realising as I was thinking ahead of this episode, and I'm sorry that this is my life story, by the way.
No, this is so fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing this.
No, it's fascinating.
Oh, it's a very good one.
It's okay. I realised that early exposure to the big, grand, colourful, emotional opera, and I love everything that's colourful and emotional and big and makes you think and makes you feel, you know, and that has really influenced me a lot. And whatever genre I'm writing in, and because I've always been into all music, I tend to be quite eclectic in where I listen, but whatever genre I'm writing in, I realise that influence is there.
Mm. Yeah.
Some of the stuff I listened to at an early age, you know, I remember when I went to see Turandot for the first time and the first act with the chorus just blasting away, you know, and I might be writing, you know, electronic music or whatever, but that ambition, I guess, of kind of what you're trying to do remains. And I have to say, it tends to be what the clients really love as well. Mm. And they don't even know it's that influence from opera that they're loving, but I think it is. Yeah. So I always say I've done loads of things, but I've never had a career. So.
That's such an incredible story, though, Katie.
Yeah. I realised about, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago that what my taste in music is, because it's also eclectic, what my taste in music is I needed to just be big, sweeping and romantic and epic.
Yeah. So that's opera all over, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
I as you were speaking then, I was like, oh, I wonder if that's why, because from a very young age, that's what I was listening to, like these epic, as you said, like wall of sound sometimes, and all these harmonies and just like sweeping romance and yeah.
I always like musicals. I mean, I'm that kind of stereotypical gay. It is a stereotype, and I'm quite happy. I'm quite happy to own that. But like, you don't often see that transcend to opera because, as Katie said, there are elitism issues, or at least perceptions, and particularly when you are non-white, you also will not really see non-white performers. I don't think any of the productions I saw as a teen or in my early 20s, had a non-white lead.
Yeah, it's really rare in general in theatre too.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed very much now. I think the last thing I went to see was the same.
Exactly.
That said, some of my favourite opera singers are not white. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I should get recommendations, or if you have recommendations, I'd really be interested because I haven't seen opera or haven't been to the theatre in a very long time. So I would like to know what's good, and even of past recordings, what is good?
You have very, very handily moved me on to the next question, which is indeed, what makes a good opera? What is the difference between that is an opera and that is an opera? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I've got a hot take straight off the bat.
Ooh!
Don't listen to it in your own language.
Ooh.
Because the lyrics are bloody crap and it just spoils the whole thing. You just want to let that music wash over you and just feel the emotion from the sounds, because the lyrics are just... No.
Yeah.
they're not the focus, which is valid in a way, you know? It's not the focus.
Which is weird, at least for me, because I really like being able to understand and listen to the lyrics, but I fully get that point because some of the best stuff I have watched has been foreign language. Yeah. And the same goes for like my general taste in like pop music, particularly like Eurovision.
Yes.
Like I am much more fond of songs sung in other languages than I am often in English.
I've seen Traviata a few times. Mm. The first time I saw it in Italian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And oh my God, I loved it. It moved me so much. And then I saw it in English, or maybe it was just with English surtitles. And I was like, are you kidding me? You've just met and you're in love. No, this is ridiculous.
Katie, I think you said you had an exception.
Well, yeah, I agree with you in general. One of the exceptions I would say is when you have an English language opera written, taken from Shakespeare.
Ooh.
One of my favourites is Benjamin Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream, for example.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
I guess that's where the native language is English.
Yeah.
Mm. It works, as opposed to where it has been translated.
So the issue is the translation.
I mean, maybe some of them with this is some of the plots are absurd, you know.
I mean, it's opera. I would say that that's kind of one of the hallmarks, or at least of classical opera.
Yeah.
Mm. One of the hallmarks is that the storyline is absurd. Like, you have got these grand narratives playing out. This is not something I have studied in depth, but unless I am mistaken, it's only modern operas, like late 19th century, 20th century, that you start to get like a condensing of plots, like they are more focused on like issues of now and like more contemporary matters. Whereas your traditional opera is very grand, it's very soaring, often drawing on mythological folktale narratives for their story base, or at least fantastical things like the Magic Flute or something like that. So it's that grand absurdity, which is one of the draws for me and what makes a really good opera. But the other thing, which is just the theatricality of the production.
Mm-hmm.
Because I came to opera from enjoying theatre,
yeah, mm-hmm.
I really like it when the theatricality matches the music.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen operatic productions where the focus is on the music because you are focusing on like the singers, but they forget some of the theatricality, or the theatricality has come second or third down this. And this particularly comes where there's choreographed bits, like where there's dancing. And I often find that if there are dance segments in a opera, they have been given short shrift, because the focus is obviously on the singing. So, like, for me, all of that needs to gel well to, like, elevate it from a good opera to a great opera.
Mm.
Even more so than, like, understanding what it necessarily about, because a lot of that comes through anyway. So one of the things for me that really cemented a like an opera was particularly, like, modern tellings or like updatings of traditional opera. So, like, as I say, I don't exactly remember what the first opera I saw in a theatre was, but probably the second or third was a production of Don Giovanni at the English National Opera.
Yeah.
And this one started with a blank stage. The back of the stage, a screen elevates, a car drives on to the stage.
Oh, I've seen that one. Yeah.
Yeah, I suspected you might have. The car starts bouncing up and down, because obviously there are people in the back seat. And then a man runs on from the wings with a baseball bat and smashes in the front, the windscreen of the car. Glass goes everywhere across the stage. He pulls open the back seat door, drags out Giovanni and Anna, Don Anna, his daughter, because, I mean, the story of Don Giovanni is that Giovanni is a womanizer, and the play is all about how he gets his just desserts. Yeah, he's been having it away with Donna Anna, and her father is upset. But while all of this is going on, there's just like broken glass strewn across the stage. And then like a scene later, the stage is done up like a tavern, and there's lots of revelry, and then streamers and sawdust and everything. And like by the end of the first act, the stage is trashed. Like, it is a complete mess. And the interval is basically someone just sweeping up the stage and cleaning it for the start of the second half. And it was that which kind of cemented in me, like, a real love of this dramatic opera.
Mm. Mm. That's super cool. Gosh, I think we're going to take a break on all of those musings. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about what a good opera is. I want to find out more about Don Giovanni. I always thought that it was a romance, but apparently not. Okay. We'll be back in just a second. And welcome back. All right. So that was a really comprehensive breakdown of what you think makes a good opera, Anil. Thank you so much for that. We'll come back to Don Giovanni. Katie, what are your thoughts?
It's interesting what both Larry and Anil are saying. I kind of agree, but actually some of my favourite operas are some of the later ones in the late 19th century and the 20th century, which have plots around real life.
Mm.
Oh, there's a special word for like opera realism or something, I don't know. I should have gone and read the Wikipedia article before this, so I looked like I knew what I was talking about.
I didn't, so don't you worry.
But I do think the same applies, because although they might be looking at real life, they're trying to bring that sense of epicness to it.
Mm.
And maybe that's what I like. Maybe as a very emotional person, a very political kind of person, I feel actually ordinary people's lives deserve that level of attention and deserve to be given an epic stage to be played out on, and for wonderful music to be underlining what they're going through.
Mm.
So, yeah, you mentioned La Traviata. I actually think that once you dig into the ridiculous plot, actually there's some really important stuff there about, at the end of the 19th century, what it is to be a woman, and can you have any power, and can you have any kind of agency or ownership over your own life, you know?
Mm. Same goes for Carmen.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And so although it's ridiculous, it allows you another way to look at like the human experience.
Mm.
And you know, that's not to decry the fantastical ones, which I adore as well. But I think that element is in there. I think that became a really important part of what opera is over the centuries as it developed. And that became a really important thing that it was trying to do.
Mm.
Or at least the composers were trying to do. I don't know if the audiences were that bothered, but the librettists and the composers were trying to do it.
Yeah, no, I get that, because like those are issues that show up in like La Boheme, like modern audiences might know better as Rent.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah,
and the transition of operas to musicals has been a long-standing one. But yeah, no, I very much get that, like, taking those issues and such and adding that extra layer to them would have been like some of the best ways to get those messages across at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, art usually is.
Mm.
It's always can be a really useful way to communicate about stuff that's happening.
Yeah.
And I mean that like in every single kind of art that we have, including comedy.
Mm.
I might even go so far as to say, including podcasts, but we shan't toot our own horns.
Dear listeners, you can be the judges of that.
Yes. Digital hashtag content. So in my head, Don Giovanni was like a tragic romance in which Giovanni was like some love-struck kid and like trying to get married or something.
No.
And then dies at the end.
Not quite. He does die at the end, to be fair.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Do you know how he dies?
Beheaded.
Do you know what? I don't think I've ever seen it.
Really?
I don't know anything about this story.
So yeah, Don Giovanni is he's a love-struck womanizer. He is a young nobleman who basically wants to cut his way through like swathes of Italian noble women
and all the rest.
Oh dear!
But the story is for this one is that he fixates on Donna Anna and spends like most of the production trying to woo her and such. Obviously, she has feelings for him as well, but there's. Mm. Whole bunch of like political stuff and things around it. But at the end, he is confronted with a final decision. Give up your womanizing ways or pay the price. He refuses to and is dragged to hell.
It's actually kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Done in the uber traditional versions, like you would have choruses of demons and such just like wandering around waiting for him to make this final decision. Because it's like there's a lot of supernatural elements to this. It gets kind of horrific, because some of the schemers start to worry about like, are they doing the right thing and things like that. But yeah, the final decision is that he is dragged off to hell because he refuses to repent or recant his ways.
That's the ending of quite a lot of operas, isn't it? Or have I just seen that scene from Don Giovanni a lot?
Really, it's not the ending, but it should be, because there's this interminable final scene where everybody sort of discusses it for a long time. It's just, it really, the energy curve just drops off. It's,
To be fair, I think in the production I saw, they shortened that a lot because it's also got the wedding of Don Anna to her actual fiance, like after a year of mourning or something like that. And the father being all is well and good and things like that. But yeah, there is a fair bit of moralizing after that. But as I say, the E&O production cut a lot of that out, if I remember correctly. But yes.
Now I want to ask the big question, which is, can we talk about the Phantom of the Opera? Yeah, that and the Marriage of Figaro are my two links to opera. That is all I basically know about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Phantom of the Opera is not a opera in any way, shape or form.
I know it's not, but it's about an opera and therefore it is valid for this episode.
It is. I actively dislike the Phantom of the Opera.
Really? So, why?
Yeah. I just think Christine and Raoul are two of the most selfish people in the world. I just hate it. And that's why. I had a friend who was in it and I went to see it and I was like, you were brilliant. I hated it. Though I do love the song Masquerade.
Yes.
Oh, that's a great song.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with you in the slightest. As a story, Phantom of the Opera is not a great story. It doesn't really help anybody or put anybody in a very good light. That said, I do enjoy the music from it. As you say, Masquerade is a great song. Yeah. And obviously, it giving Sarah Brightman, showcasing her range as a young star. And also, I have I really don't know why, and I probably shouldn't. I have a great deal of affection for the last Phantom of the Opera film.
With Gerard Butler?
Yes.
That was my first exposure to Phantom of the Opera. Yeah. Loved it.
And it's because it is a big, over-the-top production of it, it has a lot of those hallmarks that I like about opera. And it put them into... It showcased it on the big screen. And yeah, as I say, I probably shouldn't like it because there are a lot of problematic elements to The Phantom of the Opera.
Mm. Oh, a hell of a lot, yeah. Awful message.
But it is enjoyable.
I will say, I always hated Raoul. I was like, he is such a boring so-and-so.
Yeah.
Always, though.
I just remember there being a moment where he is trying to convince Christine to do something really dangerous when he should be doing the opposite. And she does something as well. I was like, I hate you both. I hate you both. So angry.
My fun fact, though, about that film, the guy who plays Raoul went on to be a massive, well, not massive, but he's in several horror franchises now. He's in the Conjuring Universe franchise as Ed Warren. And he was in Insidious as whatever his name was, the dad in Insidious. So I actually associate him more with horror now than with... But it's so weird to think back and see, oh, yeah, he can sing, actually.
Oh.
Mm. And he does sing in the Conjuring Enfield Poltergeist film. Got a nice little guitar, sings to the kids. It's very sweet. Anyway, Patrick Wilson, that's his name. Katie.
Yes.
How accurate do you think Phantom of the Opera is in portraying what opera is like?
I don't know a lot about Phantom of the Opera. I'm really sorry.
Oh, have you not seen it?
No, I haven't. I gather from what you were saying that Raoul is a tenor.
Yes.
Yes.
Why are they all like that?
Okay, in Phantom of the Opera, Christine is like the understudy.
She's the ingenue.
Yeah, the ingenue.
Yeah.
And there's a scary man who lives beneath the opera building,
right,
who falls in love with her and starts giving her singing lessons. And then poisons, well, not exactly poisons, but he puts something in the main soprano's
Carlotta
drink.
Oh, right, to give her her big break sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Like Carlotta, so that she can't sing properly.
Yeah.
And so Christine has to step up and show off and like then gets like loads of the major parts.
He threatens to kill everyone if they don't Christine the main role, right? It's not just like he's like, you have to make it Christine.
I mean, yeah, that comes a little bit later. At first it's just a bit of trickery. Then he threatens to kill everyone unless they put on his special opera that he's written for him and Christine to star in, which is very sexy. There's a... God. Oh, yes. Past the Point of No Return.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Actually, that is a great song. Yeah, that is a great song.
And that's the thing. It's like the film has a very good version of Past the Point of No Return.
Yes. Gosh. Oh, God. Do I still remember any of the lyrics? No, I don't. I just remember, past the point of no return, ba-dum, ba-dum. And it's so scary. All this, it's so great. And they're like on top of this like scaffolding.
Yeah.
And she's like got this sort of flamenco type dress. Again, one of the formative scenes from my childhood. Absolutely terrifying and very sexy scene. Anyway, the Phantom of the Opera wants Christine to basically run away with him and live underneath the opera house in a cave.
Okay.
I mean, it's Paris. It's beneath the opera relay.
Yeah.
Oh, is it a specific opera house? I didn't know. I thought it was just a fictional one.
No. It is the primary Parisian opera house. Mm. Like, I made a special point of going to see it when I got to Paris very early on in the year I was living there. Because this is an iconic piece of musical architecture.
Yeah,
it is just as grand as it is depicted. I suspect that they probably did use the actual opera house in the film, but I don't know for certain.
Mm. Oh, yes, I forgot to say as well. So the Phantom of the Opera, he always wears a mask because he has a scarred face.
Yeah. Does he sing in this mask? Sorry, just to clarify.
Yeah.
It's a very conveniently half mask that leaves his nose and mouth.
Oh, one of those ones. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's kind of like over his eyes and half of his face, but doesn't obscure the mouth.
Yes.
That's creepy.
Because it was Michael Crawford who originated the role in the West End.
Oh, dear. My popular culture knowledge is so bad.
I mean, Katie, I don't think this is popular culture knowledge.
No.
I'm not sure this is quite well.
Many of us will probably remember Michael Crawford more as Frank Spencer in Some Mothers Do Have 'Em.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yes. Whereas he is actually a very big star of musicals.
I had absolutely no idea.
He was in Half a Sixpence as well, right?
I believe so. He's done a lot. Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Phantom ends up dying because Christine betrays him and decides to go back to Raoul.
It's a bit ungrateful, really, isn't it?
We're coming to time, so I'm going to ask you a really difficult question to round us off with, which is, if you were to recommend an opera to someone to see for the first time, what would be like your starter's opera to get someone interested in it?
Oh, my goodness.
I have two answers. One is a bit of a cheat. And the more we've been talking, the more I realise that I know a lot of songs and pieces from opera. And I haven't watched that many because I always listen to like compilation CDs. So I think getting a compilation CD, they're probably going to be like the really famous ones. But if you listen to a compilation, you will realise, oh, I actually do know a lot of this because it's used so much in like advertising or in TV and film and things like that. And that's quite a nice way to find out what you like. In terms of an opera, I think my favourite could be different at any given time, but one that has stayed with me for so, so long and I keep coming back to is Carmen. I just love it. Mm-hmm. It's so romantic and passionate and I love it. So I would highly recommend. And you will know, if you're going to know any operatic songs, you will know a few from Carmen. There are some real bangers in there that are like really popular.
Carmen's the one with the red dress, right? And she has a red flower in her hair.
Yeah, it's very sexy. Actually, Helen, if you haven't listened to Carmen or watched it, I think you'd enjoy it. It's a very sexy opera.
Excellent, thank you.
It's very good. It's probably why I like it, actually.
I saw a production of that at the Albert Hall, where it was performed in the round.
Oh, wow.
And it ended up with, they'd built like a pillar where the stage usually is. And it's like Carmen throughout the opera is like dancing around in the round and then making away and slowly edging away up to towards that pillar and at the end of the show. And that,
can I ask for no spoilers though for people who okay, you're good.
For the final scene, let's say
I can guess considering what I know about operas, which is not much. What about you, Katie? What would you recommend?
Oh man, it depends what you want.
Yeah.
Can I give a number of responses?
Yeah. Go on then.
I want to hear what you're going to say.
Okay. So the ones which are often recommended as being quite accessible with like really good tunes and really fun to watch are The Marriage of Figaro. And then quite a few of the Puccini ones. La Boheme's often mentioned because that's very colourful and has got good tunes. And it's really larger than life. But I would say, depending on what you're into, there are some others that you might want to check out. If you want something a bit more up to date, I would look at John Adams again. Actually, maybe the one that's made the biggest impression on me in the last 15 years has been Dr. Atomic, which is the one about the Manhattan Project and Oppenheimer.
Ooh.
Really, really, really enjoyed that, even the first time I watched it. Or you could look at, there's a weird one to recommend, but I'm going to say it anyway because it's one of the off-the-wall ones. There's one opera in the world which is based on a comic book. Or a comic story, a comic strip.
Wow.
And that is The Cunning Little Vixen by Janáček.
Oh.
Oh, I've heard of that.
My singing teacher was in that.
Oh.
Yeah.
I really like Janáček's music. It's kind of early 20th century, or 20th century. Mm. But it's, for me, it's got a big, strong atmosphere. And the themes are all about nature, really. And like life cycles and mortality.
Wow.
And all that sort of thing. And I really enjoy that.
So, as I say, coming into this as like the more casual opera viewer, it's like, in terms of like accessibility, we've talked about Gilbert and Sullivan and operettas, and they are definitely catchy, and they are definitely some of the easiest ways to get into the format. One I would say that hasn't been already mentioned is The Barber of Seville. Because it's very fun, and it's easy, like it's very easy to grasp the plot. I would say, at least from my perspective, the comic operas tend to be easier to get into as an entry point because the plots are more straightforward and you can more readily grasp nuances that you might not in something that is a bit more dramatic or a bit more tense. I will say that if we're doing, let's not do this one as your first opera. Berlioz is The Trojans. So again, this was a production I saw at the ENO. It is usually performed in two parts over consecutive nights in repertory. I saw a full production of it.
Oh, no.
It is 4.5 hours long.
Wow.
Plus about an hour or so of intervals. And the main reason for that, for it being done this way at the ENO, was that the big break was so that they could build a battleship on stage.
I mean, that's epic.
Because it's effectively trying to tell the whole story of the Trojan War.
Oh, that's a rough one to try and...
Not so much the Trojan War, the aftermath of the Trojan War. So from the fall of Troy to basically most of what happens in the Aeneid. Mm. So it's about Aeneas and Dido.
That's still a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's very dense.
Yeah.
It was great visually, but I couldn't tell you really what happened in the plot without... I know the Aeneid, and I still wouldn't be able to tell you. But what I would say is... There are a lot of operas which are said to be like, this is the best thing that a given composer has done. They are not necessarily the best way to get into the genre or get into or get an appreciation for what that composer can do. It's a case of building up to it.
Fair enough. I'm going to be really cheeky, I'm sorry. And I want to put a shout out for De Fledermaus, which is actually, I think, to be credited, because that's an operetta.
Mm.
And it's such a fun romp.
Cool. Well, on those recommendations, we're going to have to finish the episode.
Aww.
Oh, this is so cool to talk about because I don't know anything about opera. I've learned so much. Thank you. Listener, I hope you've also enjoyed this and maybe you'll also be checking out some operas later on. I hope you do. I will see you in the next episode. But for now, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye. And it's goodbye from all of them. Do you want to say goodbye, everyone?
Goodbye! Goodbye.
Enthusiasm is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 international license. It is directed by Helen Gould, produced by Lowry Ann Davis, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner, and edited by Marissa Ewing, Tessa Vroom, Jeffrey Nils Gardner, and Catherine Ranella. Thanks for listening.